After a divisive and tumultuous 4 years under the Trump administration, President-elect Joe Biden has called for unity among Americans. But he may have to start with his own party. Here's moderate Democrat and Virginia Representative Abigail Spanberger on a private call with other House members last week following Joe Biden's win.
And we need to not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again. Because while people think it doesn't matter, it does matter. And we lost good members because of that.
On the flip side, progressives like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pushed back against claims by centrists like Spanberger on Sunday on CNN's State of the Union.
When we kind of come out swinging, not 48 hours after Tuesday, when we don't even have solid data yet, pointing fingers and telling each other what to do, it deepens the division in the party, and it's irresponsible. It's irresponsible to pour gasoline on these already very delicate tensions in the party.
For more on the tensions simmering within the Democratic Party and how the party moves forward, we're joined now by Charlotte Alter, senior correspondent at Time and author of The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Joel Payne, Democratic strategist, CBS News political contributor, and host of the podcast, Here Comes the Pain. Joel, great to have you on the show.
Good to be with you.
So, Joel, there seem to be two major camps within the Democratic Party today, and we just heard a little bit of that back and forth. What's at the root of all of this?
Well, what's at the root of all of this is credit and blame. Who gets credit for Joe Biden winning? Who gets blame for the losses in the House Democratic Caucus? And what's interesting to me, and I've repeatedly said this on a couple of appearances, in the aftermath of the election, is, you can count on Democrats to always snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I mean, this was a good week for Democrats that we're talking about. You're talking about Joe Biden's going to win by probably nearly 5 million electoral votes, rather 5 million popular votes, over 300 electoral votes. He's going to flip five states. Democrats are going to net two seats in the Senate, and they're going to hold the House. Yes, there were some losses, but that is, by any account, a pretty good week in your kind of political evolution as a party. However, the fact that there were some losses in some kind of frontline vulnerable seats for Democrats, that's the genesis of all of this. I think I probably align a little bit more with the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez view of the world, which is it's probably not the time really to be cannibalizing each other. And I do think that there is an active effort to try to maybe reclaim the party from the progressives. You've heard not only Abigail Spanberger, but you've heard folks like Jim Clyburn being very vocal and trying to assess that blame. We'll see where it all shakes out, but this is the ultimate credit blame game that we're in the midst of right now.
Charlotte, to that point, I mean, we've heard a lot about the back and forth here between progressives, and a lot of progressive voters, Joe Biden was not their candidate, but they voted for him anyway. And the sense is that they're going to keep his and Harris's feet to the fire during particularly the first 100 days. But how have we seen this division play out in the past week, Charlotte?
So I think the big problem for Democrats is that, the energy in the party is at one end of this spectrum, on the progressive end of the spectrum, but the swing votes that they need to hold the House, to win the Senate, and to win the presidency are on the other side of that spectrum. And we saw that play out very clearly in the primary when, Bernie Sanders had this extremely energetic, extremely organized and effective base of young and not young, but most young people were with Bernie Sanders in this primary in 2020. They were extremely organized. They were extremely enthusiastic. They were extremely devoted. They ran a terrific campaign. And yet the places that the Democratic candidate needed to win in order to win the nomination and then win the presidency are simply not that progressive. If only New York and California and big cities like Detroit and Chicago and Minneapolis, if those were the only places that decided political outcomes, then I think we would have much more progressive policy in this country. But I think in some ways, one of the takeaways of Joe Biden's win was that this country is a lot more moderate than many progressives wish it was.
Joel, I want to pick up on that because I think that that's a, we talked a little bit about this on the show yesterday, how Joe Biden may struggle to achieve this sort of party unity that he's been looking for. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you think that in the first couple, 100 days, that there will be some attempts to either placate progressives or move further to the center?
Well, I think what you're seeing are the battle lines being drawn out and how this all shakes out, kind of this period of assessing what happened. I think it will determine how Biden deals with all the different parts of his coalition. I think if you see that most people arrive at the idea that progressives push too far to the left, I think there'll be less pressure on Biden to, whether it's name nominees to his cabinet that are more progressive or lead with agenda items that are more progressive, maybe, kind of like a Green New Deal type of stuff or, progressive taxation, right? Those are the things that the left wanted in exchange for being loyal to Joe Biden during the campaign. Whether or not Biden has a push to do that earlier on, I think this period that we're within right now, where the narratives are being set, I think that that will indicate that. So this is very consequential for how Biden will govern this period of time. And honestly, I do think that, to Charlotte's point, Democrats have to be careful not to alienate that progressive base, because when you think about cities like Philly, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Atlanta, those are the cities that actually delivered this presidency for Joe Biden. And things like police reform and, kind of leveling the playing field between, the wealthy and the less wealthy, those were issues that did drive excitement and enthusiasm for those voters. So it is a very careful balance that Democrats have to consider.
Charlotte, let's pick up on some of the issues, the specific issues that are at the center of this sort of split between more progressive Democrats and more centrist Democrats. Are we talking about things like defunding the police, Medicare for all? What are the real top concerns here for more progressive Democrats?
So, yeah, I think we're talking about Medicare for all. We're talking about a Green New Deal. And we're talking about sort of building this sort of 21st century social safety net that people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren ran on in the primary and really captured particularly young Democrats with that vision. And I think one of the things that Joe Biden was actually very smart about as he, after he sewed up the nomination, was that he reached out to some of the top policy people in the Bernie Sanders camp and said, hey, come form a task force with my campaign. Let's work together. Let's try to hammer out, some places where both the moderate and the progressive wing of the party can kind of find consensus. And that's one of the reasons why, to their credit, the progressive wing of this party really, really got behind Joe Biden in the general election. We did not see the kind of sniping and backbiting that many felt characterized the 2020 general election, when some of Bernie's supporters didn't really get on board with Hillary Clinton until the very last minute. That didn't happen this time, partly because Biden was very explicit about reaching out a hand and inviting progressives in to offer their ideas. And progressives that I spoke to felt like, there were places where they were never going to agree, but at least they felt heard, they felt respected, they felt like their position was taken seriously. And so I think the question now for Joe Biden is, can he maintain that posture as a president? Can he continue to be a unifier as a president? And also, to what extent does being heard sort of placate this wing of the party if they don't actually necessarily get results from that?
And that's exactly one of the questions, Joel, I'll pose to you, is that if, Joe Biden has said, for example, he's not against fracking, he's not for defunding the police. Those are things that are really important to a lot of progressive Americans. And so, how far is he going to be able to take that centrist stance, when it comes to a significant portion of the Democratic electorate?
That's fair, but I do think that we sometimes get a little reductive in how we talk about these issues. Like, most people, even most progressives, don't really talk about, quote, defund the police. Really, what you're talking about is like police reform. There was a bill that a lot of moderates got behind in the Senate Democratic and House Caucus that Republicans wouldn't allow movement on. And that was a pretty middle of the road bill. There were some places where they reached, but that's really what we're talking about. You know, Jim Clyburn, I've heard him say sloganeering is a problem here. And I think there's a good point to that. But no, I think, just to
insert here, Joel, I do think it also is particular to this issue, defunding the police. There are those who are straight abolitionists who believe that police departments should be completely abolished. And then there are those who consider more what you're talking about, which is a redistribution of funds to social services programs. And I think that the folks who want complete abolition are the ones who are not going to be satisfied with Joe Biden's approach.
That's right, Tanzina. And I think what is at issue here is, like, how many people is that really, right? Like, I don't think that that's a majority of Democrats in America who are there, or at least enough to where this should be an issue that Democrats should be focusing on a week after a pretty historic election of Joe Biden and going into power in 2021 with a lot of wind at their back. And I think that's what Democrats like myself probably would hope, is that instead of, like, cannibalizing each other about this, you know, Democrats maybe quietly deal with family issues as opposed to spending the entire week after the election talking about this. I think that's what's at issue here.
Charlotte, how much of this is generational? Is it really, you know, just a new guard coming in and the old guard, and a lot has been made of the old guard, you know, just in terms of tenure and even, you know, in other areas on both sides of Congress here? I mean, we're seeing folks who've been in these positions, including Joe Biden, for more than 40 years. So how much of this is a generational divide where it's new folks who are coming in saying, we want to see some change?
So I think that it certainly is generational, but it's not quite as cleanly generational as people tend to think. So absolutely, this progressive wing of the party is characterized by this kind of youthful energy. You know, young people tend to really favor a Green New Deal, really favor Medicare for All, really favor free public college. And certainly people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are carrying that mantle. But, you know, the other thing we have to remember is that there also are a lot of young, fresh faces in Congress who are moderates, who are representing the areas that, you know, that kind of actually make or break the political future for Democrats. For example, in Michigan, Haley Stevens, Alyssa Slotkin are also in Congress along with Rashida Tlaib. And, you know, they have just as much of a vote as she does. They represent just as much of Michigan as she does. And they are more moderate than she is. So I think it's a little reductive to say that all young Democrats fall on one side of this progressive to moderate spectrum. One thing that I did find in my research for my book, which is largely about this, is that this younger generation that's coming into Washington, you know, they don't always agree on the solutions, but they do tend to agree on what the problems are. So these young people who are coming in are more concerned about climate change. They're more concerned about college affordability. They're more concerned about equitable access to healthcare. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody supports the Green New Deal as it's currently imagined, or everybody supports abolishing private health insurance in favor of Medicare for All. Progressives tend to sometimes present it as if there's broad uniformity, like every young person in America supports this very specific set of legislation exactly as they've been articulated. And it's just a little bit more complicated than that.
That complexity, Joel, is something that has honestly gotten lost in a lot of policy conversations, particularly among Democrats and among uber progressives. I've experienced it myself on social media when talking about things and just asking questions about things like what it means to defund the police, where it can really become you can become unable to even have a conversation about some of this. And I think, Joel, I wonder if progressives are going to feel very frustrated with the next couple of years because of that real sense of it's either this way or no way.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tanzina. I mean, look, progressives struggle to even appreciate the Obama years where you actually had uniformity of kind of government leadership. I worked in Harry Reid's majority leader's office when Democrats had the White House and the Senate and the House. And still, there was a lot of bellyaching from the base. Maybe some of it fair, but a lot of it unfair, because there's a difference between governing and campaigning. And when you govern it, you can't, you know, you there is a certain amount of deal making that has to happen, which actually positions Joe Biden pretty well. I think one thing that Biden and his team have done well is not overcommit him. And they've been very adept at setting expectations, even on kind of what happened over the summer related to George Floyd. And you saw how Biden responded to that moment. I actually think he was very agile and he did what the retail politics he needed to do at the moment, but he did not take himself so far out of the mainstream that it was a position that was going to hurt him with the entire coalition. So I actually think Biden might be uniquely qualified to manage this moment. But yes, progressives are always going to be frustrated with the governing process. That is something I have learned from about 15 years in and around, you know, Democratic politics at the national level. And I imagine that's going to continue into the near future.
Joel, I have to ask you about this campaign in terms of finance, in terms of the amount of money that went into this campaign for the Democrats. I mean, there were races here that had seen, especially following the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, donations flowing into Democratic Senate candidates and even Joe Biden. How would you characterize how much was spent this year for the Dems?
Well, there were ungodly sums of money that were spent, and Democrats have always had a kind of uneasy relationship with that much money and you know what we spend on how we elect people. As you know, I'm sure Tanzina, I'm sure Charlotte can speak to this as well. The Citizens United case was something that was very, very corrosive to a lot of people who vote like me and who think like me. But you also understand that if those are the rules, You have to live by those rules. And I do think, you know, Democrats were able to do that effectively this cycle. I think the one thing I will say is that the money raised and the money spent does serve as a somewhat of a barometer of energy. And I think energy and enthusiasm was high on the Democratic side. That's why you had a lot of money raised. By the way, it wasn't all like, you know, Wall Street donors, you know, raised money. It was small and mid dollar fundraisers from people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Biden finally got his fundraising apparatus up to that over the summer after he was the presumptive nominee. But it wasn't your traditional, you know, bundler driven fundraising operation that Democrats had. There was a really strong small and mid dollar operation that Democrats and that Biden were able to lead. I imagine they will continue to be able to do that. We'll see another test of it, by the way, in a couple of weeks with that Georgia runoff, the double runoff in Georgia with the Purdue seat and also the open seat that Raphael Warnock and Kelly Loeffler are going to be going after.
Charlotte, to that point, I mean, let's talk a little bit about what effect the Biden win, or at least for now, has on the energy and activism that comes from the left, particularly the progressive left. Are you seeing, let's look at Georgia, you know, are there going to be people mobilized to try and turn that Senate race blue, shift the balance of power there? Do you see that Biden's win has actually energized progressives?
So I do think that there's going to be a tremendous amount of energy and money focused on Georgia. I think it's an open question as to whether or not that energy is necessarily, you know, fairly characterized as progressive, as the way progressives define it. You know, I don't think either John Ossoff or Reverend Warnock are in the AOC style of progressive. And I think that this gets back to what I was saying earlier about how, you know, what works in the Bronx and in Detroit and in, you know, the Boston area is not necessarily what's going to win Senate seats in Georgia. And I think nobody knows that better than Stacey Abrams. And so one of the lessons that Democrats learned very well in 2018 was to let the people, to let locals do the local organizing, to focus on what works in that particular district, in that particular state, in that particular region, without getting lashed to a national narrative. And I think that's much harder in a presidential campaign where you do have somebody at the top of the ticket, where you do have the party making nationwide decisions about who it is and what it stands for. And I think that's why you're seeing these tensions erupt, because in 2018, it was much easier for you know, Stacey Abrams to run on her issues and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to run on her issues and Ayanna Pressley to run on her issues. And those didn't all have to be the same. And 2020, you know, sort of required the Democratic Party to come into a little bit more consensus. And that's where all this tension is coming from.
Joel, I want to round out this conversation by asking you about the fact that when Joe Biden gave his speech, presumably accepting, announcing that they had won over the weekend, at least the Electoral College votes, he made it very clear to point out his support from one of the largest voting blocs for Democrats, which is Black Americans. And he pointed and said, "You have had my back, and I will have yours." I'm paraphrasing there. But what is that going to look like, Joel? I mean, how will Joe Biden be able to keep that promise to Black voters?
I think Black voters will be reminding him of it at every turn. It's really poetic if you think about it. Black voters deliver the primary to Joe Biden when really, I mean, by all accounts, Joe Biden did not perform well in that Democratic primary. His campaign was always better for the general than for the primary. But when he was at the kind of bottom of the barrel in South Carolina, Black voters just looked at the field and just said, "This stops here, this stops now." And starting in South Carolina and going through those SEC primary states, Mississippi, Alabama, et cetera, they decided that Joe Biden was going to be the standard bearer of the party. They are the darkest blue bloc of Democratic voters, particularly Black women, and they delivered that primary to him. And if you actually look on what happened during the election, they delivered the election to Joe Biden. Again, in cities like Philly, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Milwaukee, Atlanta, that was Black voters who put Joe Biden over the top in a way that they were not able to do for Hillary Clinton. And I think a lot of African-American voters took that personally, particularly, again, those really reliable African-American voters in that block. And I think that they just decided that Joe Biden was the only person that could beat Donald Trump. And that was the existential crisis. And I think that that was kind of level one. It was kind of a two-step process. Level one, beat Trump. Level two, be able to hold Biden accountable. And I think that they certainly will.
Joel Payne is a Democratic strategist and host of the podcast Here Comes the Pain. And Charlotte Alter is a senior correspondent at Time and author of The Ones We've Been Waiting For: How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.